I think it's very important to explore the intersections of science and faith. And I try to do it in my own talks in several ways. One is to give profiles on scientists who also were religious, either actually religious, like priests and brothers and sisters and so forth, but also people who have done work who are practicing Catholics or Christians or Jews or Muslims, whatever, and to profile those people to counter the notion that somehow science and faith are contradictory aspects of the human psyche. That's not the kind of talk I'm going to give tonight. The talk I'm going to give tonight is more along the lines of exploring the implications of a very interesting problem in science for Christian faith or in general monotheistic faith, but I am going to focus on Catholicism in particular. And I'm not a theologian, I'm a scientist, so when we get to the part about Thomas Aquinas, hopefully people who are better educated in areas of theology and philosophy will step in and turn this from a lecture into a discussion. So what I'm going to do first is to talk about some of the misconceptions that we kind of hear about whether there is an abundance of other life in the cosmos, almost a cultural meme to think of aliens as being everywhere in the cosmos, and to explain why we don't really know that at all. We have no constraints on that whatsoever. And then I'll talk about ways that we might begin to approach answering that question, both indirectly and directly. And then I'll talk about the implications for Catholicism. So, the question that motivates the scientific search for life elsewhere is whether we're alone in the universe. And this little goblet, which embarrassingly enough I didn't clean before I took a picture of it, has on it an equation that we're going to be talking about for the first part of the talk, called the Drake equation. At this point in time, we don't know. We have no evidence for life anywhere else in our solar system or beyond. All of life on Earth, as we understand it, had a common origin. That is, all life on Earth, no matter how morphologically different one from the other, is biochemically the same. It is possible that life as we know it, which is essentially based on what we call the cell and DNA and proteins and so forth, that different aspects of that had separate independent origins on the Earth a long, long time ago. But at some point, very early in the history of life, well before any chemical fossil evidence of any kind, that life symbiotically became this singular kind of life that's represented by the three domains of bacteria, archaea, and eukaryotes. We, our cells, are eukaryotic cells that are complex cells, but we have very strong relationships with the other two domains, the bacteria and the archaea, and you can see that in the genes, and you can see that in the mechanisms and the chemistry of life. So, as far as anyone can tell, there is one kind of life that we know of here in the cosmos, and it's the life we have on Earth. So, what are the chances of having a large amount of life elsewhere in the cosmos? Well, it seems to make sense that there ought to be plenty of life elsewhere. The sort of Copernican philosophy would say that we're not unique in any way. Everything we've learned about the Earth and our solar system and so forth would suggest in some way that life ought to be common. And typically this is expressed by writing out an equation called the Drake equation, which is not really an equation that computes anything in the sense of a mathematical structure to calculate a physical process. It's really a way of just laying out the different factors that determine the abundance of life. And it also is a good way of understanding how ignorant we are of most of the factors that go into whether life is abundant or not, and how difficult it is to actually determine the values for those factors. So the way this is typically written, and this was invented by Frank Drake, a radio astronomer who spent much of his career at Cornell before moving to this area, the Bay Area, and working at the SETI Institute, directing a part of it for a number of years. The way this is written is that expression computes n, which is the number of civilizations in our galaxy with which we might expect to be able to communicate at any given time. And so immediately, you recognize that this is an equation about the abundance of self-aware, intelligent, complex life that is technological. You can write a similar equation for just life in general by truncating some of the terms on the right, and it's a lot easier to compute, but there's still a number that is very uncertain even in that truncated equation. So n depends upon r sub star, which is the rate of star formation in our galaxy, f subscript p, f sub p, the fraction of those stars that have planets, n sub e, which is the average number of planets that can potentially support life per star that has planets, f sub l is the fraction of those planets that actually go on to develop life, f sub I is the fraction of those planets that have developed life that go on to develop intelligent life, and then f sub c is the fraction of those planets that have developed intelligent life that have developed a technological capability that allows them to communicate beyond their home planet, and that there's some presumed willingness to do so. And then L is the expected lifetime of such a civilization. So let's put some numbers to this. So the two numbers that we know very well are the first two factors. The rate of star formation in our galaxy is, roughly speaking, depending on how you parse the distribution of matter versus stars, somewhere between 3 and 10 stars per year. So it's about the number of stars that Hollywood produces each year. It's about the same for the galaxy, okay? The other number, so that number has been known for a long time. It was known when Frank Drake wrote out this equation for the first time. The rest of it he didn't know, and neither did anyone else. But we do know one other number now, and that is f sub p, which is the fraction of those stars that have planets. We know that because beginning in the mid-1990s, with pioneering work done at Geneva Observatory and also here at Berkeley, it became possible to detect planets around other stars, which is a very difficult thing to do. For many decades before that had stymied astronomers. People thought it was going to be a lot easier than it was, and then finally when the right techniques were invented, it actually became a lot easier than people thought it would be. It's sort of the paradox of science. So now we know that on average, for every star in the Milky Way galaxy, depending on how you count it, there's between one and two planets. So if there are 200 billion stars in our Milky Way galaxy, there are hundreds of billions of planets, which is really a remarkable number. So I put one in that case. The fraction of stars that have planets, all stars have planets on average. And those are all the numbers we know. Now, if we try to guess the other numbers, we start to get into a game where our mind tends to convolve our philosophical leanings with our scientific estimates. And so let's be optimists in this, okay? Which many people often are. And, you know, if you watch TV, I mean, Star Trek Discovery and Star Wars and name your favorite science fiction show, the universe is full of intelligent, technologically advanced civilizations. Okay, so how do we get those? Well, we get them this way. Let's say that of those stars that have planets, which is all of them, that on average, every one of those star systems has a planet that can support life. Now, in our own solar system, we have 8 or 9 planets, depending on how you count Pluto, and of those, one can support life. And, you know, maybe, as we'll talk about in a little bit, there are some moons in the outer solar system that can support life as well. So maybe I should put 2 or 3 here, but I put 1. All right, F sub L, the fraction of the above that actually go on to develop life. Now, here's where your philosophy comes in. because when you have a planet that's habitable and it's left alone, do you think that it's just naturally going to form life? I mean, after all, that's what happened on the Earth, right? So why shouldn't it happen somewhere else? If there's an Earth-like planet orbiting another star, somewhat like the Sun, and it forms and it has water and it has an atmosphere and it has a magnetic field to prevent that atmosphere from being eroded away by the stellar wind, why not, right? Okay, but you know, maybe some global catastrophe takes out half of those. So let's assign the number 0.5 to F sub L. Sounds conservative. All right, so of those, what fraction actually go on to develop intelligent life, F sub I? Well, that happened here on the Earth, as much as we might want to question whether we're intelligent or not. Probably, objectively, someone would say yes, sort of. But it took a long time for this to happen. And so it's not necessarily a given that this will happen for every planet that develops life. And I'll get to that in a little bit more detail when I get to the pessimistic value in a moment. But let's assign that a half. And then the fraction that are willing and able to communicate, so intelligent life develops through Darwinian evolution and then eventually develops a civilization and they're able to communicate. And how long do they last? So I put 1,000 years here. That, for some people, might not be all that optimistic. 1,000 years isn't really a long time, right? But we've only had the ability to communicate with space through radio telescopes or to listen to communication from radio telescopes for a border 100 years. So, you know, 10 times that value, maybe we'll do ourselves in, maybe we'll run out of resources, maybe we'll get bored listening and we'll just dismantle these things. So maybe 1,000 years isn't too bad. So if you total all this up, you get 400 communicable civilizations right now in our galaxy with whom we can talk. And, you know, that's good. I mean, that'll work for Star Trek and Star Wars and so on. So that's sort of the optimistic number. Now, what if we get a little bit more pessimistic? If we get more pessimistic, for example, this number N sub E, which is the average number of planets that can potentially support life per star. So this would say that only one out of every 10 stars has a planet that can actually support life. And the reason I put that number there is that we see a lot of stars that have very close-in giant planets, planets the mass of Jupiter, that are orbiting really close to the parent star, much closer to their star than Mercury orbits to our own sun, a factor of 10 times closer or even more. Now, how did that giant planet get there? Well, it didn't form there because it's a region that's way too hot to allow ices and solids to condense out to make a core, and then an envelope collapses around that to make a giant planet. That's sort of the favored approach or mechanism. That has to happen farther out. So giant planets have to migrate inward to get to these close-in slots. And actually, the migration process is fairly well understood. There's evidence that our own giant planets migrated inward a little bit and shaped the orbits of the asteroids, the asteroid belt. So if that happens, if they go all the way in, then they're like bowling balls, and they just blast everything else away. So in those systems, maybe there's no life. Most stars that have planets that we've detected are M-dwarfs. They're cooler than the Sun. In order for a planet to be habitable, to have liquid water, the planet has to be so close to the parent star, even if it's an Earth-sized planet, that it's going to be tidally locked. Only one face is going to point toward the star, the other face is going to point away. That might not be so habitable. Okay. So if you put all this together, maybe it's a tenth and not one. All right. I'll leave F sub L the way it is for the moment. I want to get back to that. But let's go to F sub I, the fraction that can go on to develop intelligent life. The first complex animals appear in the fossil record about 600 million years ago, a little bit before the Cambrian explosion. And life, the evidence that life began, goes back somewhere between 3.5 and 3.8 billion years, depending on which evidence you believe or not. That's a huge gap, okay? The Earth is 4.55 billion years old. Life began somewhere around the 700 million year mark after the Earth formed, and it then took, from the time the Earth formed, about 4 billion years for complex life to form. That's a long time, and the question is why? But another question is, how much time is left for the Earth to be habitable? Enough time for you to get your degrees, so that's not a problem. But actually less time than you might think, because it's not the remaining lifetime of the Sun on the main sequence, which is defined as that sort of parameter space where stars are stably burning hydrogen, hydrogen fusion. Stars, as they burn hydrogen and convert that hydrogen to helium, get brighter. And as they get brighter, a planet in a given orbit is starting to approach the inner edge of what's called the habitable zone. The habitable zone is moving outward, if you will, as the star is getting brighter. And depending upon the particular calculations you look at, the Earth is going to be inward of the habitable zone, that is too hot to maintain its liquid water ocean, somewhere between a half a billion and 2 billion years from now. Okay? Neither of those is the span of history that we've already been through. So something like between 60 and 90% or 70 and 90% of the habitable time for the Earth has been consumed in making intelligent life, which is not a great number if you want to claim that that's a very common process. You really want it to take a tenth or 1% that time. You don't want it to take most of that time, because maybe we're precocious. Maybe it takes longer, all right? Maybe most planets go haywire earlier, that kind of thing. Anyway, so I put 10 to the minus 2 for that reason, because there's a good chance that it's very hard to get to that point in an evolutionary process. And I left the rest of this alone, and then you're down to less than one intelligent, communicable civilization in our galaxy. There's basically no one to talk to. We're alone in our galaxy, okay? Now, that's unfortunate. Wipes a lot of science fiction stories off the map. But it doesn't really get us to the question of what are the challenges for the Christian faith, for example. Because after all, most of those challenges don't have to do with whether you can talk to a civilization, but whether there is a civilization. And our galaxy is only one of hundreds of billions of galaxies in the cosmos. And furthermore, we're only talking about civilizations that are there today when we're present as well. We should integrate this over all of cosmic time, because if we want to worry about things like multiple incarnations, for example, it's not going to matter whether it happened 8 billion years ago or today. So the next slide just multiplies these numbers. And by the way, I hope everyone here knows scientific notation, right? So 10 to the power of 11 is, we all know that, 100 billion, right? Okay, one followed by 11 zeros. All right, so I shouldn't have to say that, because this is Berkeley. I mean, there's some places you do have to say that. Not Cornell. All right, so if I multiply by all the galaxies, my 0.2 number becomes 20 billion civilizations throughout the cosmos at this time. If I then 10 to the 3 years, which was my lifetime for civilizations, there are 10 to the 7 of those periods in the history of the universe. So I multiply by 10 to the 7, and now I get a number like, for my original 0.2, I get 2 times 10 to the 17 civilizations, which is a lot. Okay, so immediately one would ask, well, you know, are these creatures, did they fall or not? Did they need salvation? Could there then have been 2 times 10 to the 17 incarnations, the second person of the Trinity? That's where you start to get into these interesting questions about our faith that I will return to. But there is one number in this that has a huge range of ignorance, and that number, which we haven't talked much about, is the fraction of planets that can potentially support life that actually go on to produce life. And that's a number that we have no observational experience with. The Production of intelligent species, we do. It's in the fossil record. It's us, okay? Development of civilization and technology, that's our history. We can read that in history books. But we don't have a model that comes from observation of the processes by which life begins. There are lots of wonderful ideas, and a lot of progress has been made on aspects of it. But that progress doesn't tell us whether this number, F sub L, is large or small. And we have to be very careful about how large or small, because what we find in our cosmos is that there are some surprising numbers that get surprisingly big and surprisingly small when you actually compare them to their expected value. And so one example of that is dark energy. Okay, dark energy is this quantity which you can think of as related to the vacuum energy of space, which is causing the cosmos to accelerate in its expansion. So the expansion rate seems to have been constant through the first half of the history of the universe, as measured by the distance recession relationship with galaxies, and then it starts to pick up. So there's something that's increasing that rate of expansion. Physicists can calculate the vacuum energy and the effect of force fields on that vacuum energy, as well as the effect of matter on the vacuum energy. They have opposite effects. And if you just take the force fields and you calculate the value of what dark energy should be, and then you compare that to the observed value, which is based again on the relationship between the distance to galaxies and their recessional speed as a function of distance through space, you find that the measured value is smaller than the predicted value by a factor of 10 to the power of 120, which is a pretty large number. Okay? Now, apparently matter offsets the fields, but there's no expectation that the two should balance each other to such an extent that the dark energy is 10 to the minus 120 times smaller. So my point about this is that we have to be careful, because some of the numbers in the Drake equation could be extremely small numbers as well. We don't really know what it takes for life to begin in a natural environment, how long that process takes, what is required in terms of the environment, and so forth. So we're really ignorant of that number. It could be 1, it could be 10 to the minus 120, F sub L, could be any of those, we don't know. So how are we going to find out? Well, one way is to figure out how life began on the Earth. I think that's a tricky one. I'm not sure we're ever going to quite get to that point, because the time scales and the spatial scales for the processes that led from non-biological chemistry to biochemistry are very long. Another way to go about doing this is to go look for life elsewhere in our local cosmic neighborhood. We don't have to look for intelligent life or advanced civilizations. We just have to find microbial life that we can demonstrate had a separate independent origin from life on the Earth. And if we find evidence for that in several places, it suggests that F sub L is going to be not a very, very small number, but perhaps a number that is close to 1. So this is something that I'm actually involved in from the research point of view, and I want to cover in the next part of the talk some of the targets that are being examined. Now, the most natural target would be Mars, because Mars is close to the Earth, and it's always been thought of as a place where life might be present. And indeed, the explorations of Mars in the last 20 years have demonstrated that for the first billion years of Mars's history, there was liquid water on the surface, standing liquid water and running liquid water. So this is a picture from orbit of a place called Jezero Crater, and the outflow of the crater is actually left. The outflow that you see there is outflow of liquid forming a deltaic deposit, a river delta. But that river is dried up now. And it's been dried up for a very long time. And you know that because the delta itself is pockmarked with little impact craters, which don't happen all that often and would suggest that that delta's been inactive for a few billion years. But nonetheless, sometime the first billion years of Mars's history, the climate was clement enough that liquid water could exist. And then you go to places on Mars that have been explored, for example, Mount Sharp and the surroundings of Gusev Crater. What you find there, and this is an image from the Mars rover Curiosity, is that there is ample evidence that the floor of that crater was flooded and had standing liquid water for perhaps periods of millions to hundreds of millions of years. And so clearly, these are environments where life might have gained a toehold and survived. It's not going to be there today because these areas are completely dry, but you could look for the fossil evidence of that life. And in fact, there's intriguing evidence that something chemically is going on Mars. Both the Curiosity rover, this, by the way, is a selfie, and these selfies are taken by removing, with a Photoshop-type routine, the camera stick that's basically on the end that takes all the photos. So a very clever way to do it, because that really is the Curiosity rover on Mars. It detected bursts of methane in this crater that it's been exploring around Mount Sharp. And I said Gusev Crater, Gale Crater. And just recently, there's a paper, data from the Mars Express orbiting spacecraft, which showed that methane is coming from the area to the southeast of Gale Crater, which suggests that there is some source of methane. Now, one source of methane is biology, but another source of methane could be geology as well, because reactions of water with rock can produce methane, or the methane could be trapped in the ice, that sort of thing. So we don't really know whether it's geological or biological, but it's very intriguing. And maybe there are, under the surface, organisms that are producing methane, methanogens. The problem on Mars, however, is that even if we find life there, because material has been exchanged between Mars and the Earth frequently over billions of years, especially in the first part of the solar system's history, that whatever life we find there could be the same life as life on Earth. That is, it had the same origin and just got transported from Earth to Mars or Mars to Earth, either way. So the evidence for that life has to be high enough fidelity that you can actually study its biochemistry. And the problem with looking for that evidence after it's been sitting around for 3 billion years on Mars, even in the crust, is that you're not likely to get the kind of information you need, like whole cells or even long biopolymers. So there are problems with using Mars to test for F sub L. It's too close to the Earth. So let's go farther out. So this is work that I've been involved in, and this is exploring some of the moons of the outer solar system, some of which, and they're shown here in diagrammatic form, next to Mars and Venus, which once had oceans. These are places where we have either strong direct evidence for oceans or circumstantial evidence for oceans underneath their surfaces, because these are all moons that are far from the sun. Their surfaces are cold, but they are bodies that are composites of rock and ice. They've got, depending on the particular object, they can be mostly rock with a little ice, or even 50-50 rock and ice. And somewhere sandwiched between the ice and the rock, some of these have liquid water. And the three moons for which there is the best evidence are Europa, Enceladus, and Titan. Now, in order to prevent this from being a lecture on these objects, I'm only going to cover Enceladus, but it's a very interesting case. So we know about Enceladus because of the Cassini spacecraft, which completed its 20-year voyage in space in 2017, when it ran out of fuel finally, lasted a lot longer than the prime mission design of 4 years. That's a large spacecraft built by the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. It has 14 instruments on it, and then attached to the side of it was a European-built probe called the Huygens probe, named after Christian Huygens, who discovered Titan. And that probe was dropped off and landed on the surface of Titan. And this is the innards of that probe, so you get a sense of the scale of the thing. I'm not going to talk about Titan tonight because I don't have time. I'm going to talk about Enceladus. Now, whenever I say Enceladus, people say, what? Because it's such an unattractive name. It's not like Europa or Titan or Oberon, which are some of the other moons. You know, Enceladus was a Greek mythological figure. Don't ask me what he did. I think he killed some other Greek mythological figure. But it's a remarkable moon. It's only 500 kilometers across, 300 miles across, and yet it's one of the most active moons in the solar system. It's being tugged and squeezed by the planet Saturn as it moves around in a non-circular orbit. And one of the first things that Cassini saw when it arrived in Saturn orbit in 2004, about a year later, was looking at Enceladus backlit with the sun behind the screen and shining toward us, was this plume of material, of gas and ice, coming out of this tiny moon. Much too small to be heated by radioactive heating or original energy of formation, if you've taken astronomy classes. Gotta be tidal heating. Okay, so this stuff is coming out from the south polar region, which is crisscrossed with these fractures. I didn't break anything. Crisscrossed with these fractures, which themselves are about many tens of kilometers long. Those fractures, if you look at the plume close up, emit material in the form of jets and curtains. And so what you're seeing here again, low sun angle, here's the day-night terminator, and you see these individual jets that merge to form this plume. That plume of material of gas and dust and ice pours out into space, goes into orbit around Saturn, forms a ring of material that was actually discovered from the Earth in the 1960s. But although it was suspected that the source had to be Enceladus, because Enceladus was moving in the same orbit as the ring, no one knew what that mechanism was. And now we know it's these fractures that are being opened and closed by tidal forces. And in this very remarkable picture, which was part of a sequence designed at Cornell, which housed part of the imaging team, spacecraft got within 25 kilometers of Enceladus, used motion compensation to get the smear out of the images, and so we have images now with detail that's down at 50 meters or so. And you see these intricate fractures and cracks out of which this stuff is coming out. Well, once this plume was discovered, and it was determined to be safe to do so, Cassini was actually flown through the plume. And Cassini contains a number of instruments, but two of them are called mass spectrometers. And here's an example of the workings of a mass spectrometer. It's just four charged metal rods, which have an electric field imposed on them, a constant field and a time variable field. And if you modulate the variability of the field between the four rods, and you send ions of various different molecules or atoms through here, then depending on how you modulate the field, only molecules or atoms of a certain mass will make it out the other end. These are all charged particles, they're ions. So this becomes a mass detector by modulating the electric fields. And this is a very common way of analyzing some samples, whatever you want, and it's been done in space many, many times. So here's an example of a mass spectrum. I managed to chop off the amplitude here, but this is just amplitude. Ignore the x-axis, the molecular or the atomic masses. Some of these are atoms, some are molecules, are shown here. So water is 18, carbon monoxide is 28. These are all organic molecules in here, separated by 12 or 13, which is the mass of carbon or the mass of carbon and hydrogen. So they're heavy organics. These are water and salts together, so there are salts present. And so what's coming out of Enceladus is icy material and organic material, and the icy material is salty, and it contains up to 2% salt, which is half the salinity of the Earth's oceans, which tells us that that material was liquid. The salt had to be able to dissolve to that extent, then as it came out into space, it was flash frozen. So Enceladus has this remarkable chemistry in the dust and the gas, which is telling us that there is, at the base of the ocean, where the water comes in contact with rock, something that on the Earth we would call a hydrothermal system, which is a place where water is being chemically altered by the rock. And if you want a little chemistry this evening, along with the theology to come, here's a mineral, an olivine mineral, phaolite, reacting with water, making magnetite, very common mineral, plus aqueous silica, plus hydrogen. And Cassini has collected the water, the aqueous silica, and the hydrogen. It's not going to collect the magnetite and the phaolite because they're not leached out into this ocean, but the aqueous silica and the hydrogen are. So there's activity going on inside Enceladus that could support life. And so it's a great place to go back to with instruments that are capable of detecting biomolecules. Cassini's instruments were not. And so I've worked with a group at NASA's Jet Propulsion Laboratory, and there's also a competing mission from Goddard. We've tried to get NASA to buy into these missions, haven't succeeded yet. But the basic idea would be to make the kind of measurements just flying through the plume the way Cassini did with advanced mass spectrometers, and not only better determine the nature of the ocean, but also measure biomolecules. And if those biomolecules are there, then there's life, and we would in fact be able to say something about the nature of that life. And these are free samples. I mean, we don't have to drill or land or do anything. They just come out into space. So I think this is the best place to go in our solar system to find evidence for other life. Okay, so what about looking around other stars? Well, very briefly, there's so many planets around other stars to examine atmospheres for evidence of life, but it's very hard to separate the signature of the planet from the star. In fact, Giordano Bruno, back in around 1600, had written, before he was burned at the stake, that there are enormous numbers of stars, enormous numbers of planets, but you can't see the planets because they're lost in the glare of their parent stars. And that's true. And he was not burned at the stake for that. He was burned at the stake for all sorts of weird, heretical, theological notions. But he got that one right, at least. So it's very hard to separate the light of the planet from the star. But if you do, you might find all sorts of gases. This is a simulation by Sarah Seeger and colleagues from 2014. These are spectra. These are the light coming from the planet split into its component wavelengths from the visible part of the spectrum at 0.6 microns out to the infrared at 25 microns, which is hard to observe from the Earth. You'd have to observe from space. And these gases are all very interesting, but the signature of life that you would want to find, like chlorophyll, really doesn't show up in spectra with this level of what's called resolution. It's very hard to do. At best, you might find methane, and if methane is present with oxygen, well, that says that there's some kind of disequilibrium process going on, and maybe that disequilibrium process is life. But you don't know for sure. It's not like collecting biomolecules. So from my point of view, although I'm a great fan of getting exoplanet spectra, and it's something I plan to do with JWST, the first stop is in our solar system and trying to collect samples from ocean worlds like Enceladus. This, over decades, will get better and better, and maybe we'll be at the point where we can actually really detect biomolecules in the atmospheric gases, but it's going to be hard. So what about going directly for N, you know, that number of communicable civilizations? Well, that's being done too, and of course that's the SETI project, and there are many SETI projects now. SETI is the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. It started with Frank Drake and colleagues. Actually, it started before him. Here's one such project, which is being financed through the Breakthrough Foundation and is actually being done through Berkeley. And 1,700 nearby target stars are being listened to. But in an optimistic scenario, out of 100 billion stars, maybe 400 have communicable civilizations. So 1,700 nearby stars, we'd have to get pretty lucky to find a civilization. It doesn't mean we shouldn't do this, but we may have to keep listening forever to actually, you know, pick up those signals, looking star by star by star, or have a more efficient way to do it. So suppose we actually have success, all right? And by success, I mean not finding out whether F sub L is close to 1 or much less than 1. I mean, that's interesting scientifically, but success in terms of actually getting a message from another alien civilization, extraterrestrial civilization, somewhere off the Earth. What would that mean for our faith? Well, if you look to the outside world, and by the way, our faith, I apologize, means any faith, whatever faith you happen to have. I'm going to talk about Catholic faith, the Christian faith, but it may mean different things for people of different faiths. So from this point onward, I'm going to talk about Christianity in particular. So forgive me for being parochial on that, but we can have a discussion about implications for many different faiths. So there is this kind of a standard secular response to the question of what would the discovery of extraterrestrial civilizations imply for Christianity. And that standard response is it would be the end of Christianity. And interestingly, what's usually articulated is not what I'm going to argue is the real potential concern for the central tenet of Christianity. It's something else. It's that the aliens either will have a better religion than Christianity, or that they will simply outgrow religion or have outgrown religion. So these are two quotes, one from Robert Jastrow, who argues that advanced extraterrestrial life forms may have a form of monotheism superior to Judeo-Christian beliefs. How does he know that? What is superior? It's a statement that begs the question of what he actually means. It also begs the question whether there are any extraterrestrial civilizations. Because one of the things that you find with quotes like this is that you get into this sort of logical loop that assumes that you're going to find these extraterrestrial civilizations, that they're out there and it's only a matter of time, and therefore the derogatory comments about, in this case, Judeo-Christian religion simply means that those religions are defunct. They're defunct already from the point of view of these individuals. But remember, we don't know whether there are other intelligent life forms elsewhere in the galaxy. We don't know that yet. This one is interesting. Jill Tarter is a colleague of mine. I admire her greatly. We get along really well. But this is almost autobiographical because, as she says in some of her public websites, she herself identifies herself as being spiritual, but says she's outgrown organized religion. And so in this quote, she says the aliens are going to outgrow organized religion. So it's actually an autobiographical statement. So, you know, these are not very interesting because they simply reflect the prejudices that individuals have about individual religions. That's all it is. It's a reflection of their own views. There have been discussions, there have been Vatican press conferences, Vatican astronomy books, and so forth. They don't really dig into this question very deeply either. You really have to go to the theologians, the academic theologians, to understand what the implications are. So let me give you those implications as a bottom line, and then I'm going to move to a little bit of Aquinas for the last part of my talk. So this is the bottom line for Christianity, as best as I can tell. Number one, the existence, discovery of microbial or even non-sentient complex organisms on other worlds is absolutely compatible with a God who delights in the fullness of his creation. You could call it the affluence of divine goodness or the superabundance of the things that he has created in the cosmos. There's nothing wrong with that. It's all perfectly coherent. Where you run into interesting questions are in parts 2 and 3. And this has been particularly explored by Marie George, who's a theologian at St. John's University on Long Island. She wrote a whole book, Christianity and Extraterrestrials, Catholic Perspective. So the existence of other sentient organisms could potentially have an impact on our understanding of the uniqueness of the incarnation. because if some or all of those entities turn out to be fallen in the way that humans are, as we understand it in our Christian tradition, then they have to be saved. And if they have to be saved, there has to be an incarnation of the second person of the Trinity. Christ has to come to them. But Christ has already come once for all to the earth. And it is in many, many places in the Bible, once for all. So what happens? What are the implications of multiple incarnations? Or what are the implications of not having those fallen creatures be visited? And then, suppose they're not fallen, for whatever reason, okay? Then eat the apple, sort of the symbol or meme. Then you have the problem of the centrality of the incarnation of the history of the cosmos, because if there's an entire race or multiple species of organisms living out their lives in the cosmos without any knowledge of God, of the Trinity, and not having need of that, it potentially displaces what should be the central story of the history of the cosmos from its central position. And there's another interesting question, which I'm not going to try to cover here, about the image of God, just because for lack of time. So how do we answer this? Well, one way is to go to some of the great theologians, philosophers, scholastics. Thomas Aquinas is one of them. And much of what I'm going to say comes from Marie George's article from 2001. So Aquinas' thinking on this subject is shaped by his cosmology, which is geocentric. He doesn't allow for the existence of other worlds like the Earth, and so he doesn't actually allow for other intelligent beings that are like humans. He either talks about what is required for human to not be a human if you chop off certain aspects of our bodies, or, interestingly, he talks about intelligence being imbued in or united with celestial bodies in a different way than our intelligence and our soul is united with us. And there's a very long discussion of those differences, which I won't get into here. But the main point is that prevents him from addressing points 2 and 3 on the previous slide directly. Nonetheless, he makes some very important points, which George points out. One is that Aquinas doesn't see a problem for ETs in the Christian faith from the point of view that they are not mentioned in the Bible. And he discusses here that Scripture, the fact that Scripture doesn't mention an entity doesn't mean it doesn't exist. He talks about how certain spiritual beings were left out of the Old Testament, or they were signified by the names of corporeal things, because Moses spoke to uneducated people who are not yet able to grasp incorporeal nature. So people's understanding of spirit and incorporeal intelligence has evolved culturally with time, and Aquinas recognizes that. And he says, faith in Scripture is intended for our salvation and not for instruction in science. It's a very important point we need to remember today. All right, but now here's the question about multiple incarnations. Aquinas goes on in the Summa Theologia, in Volume 3, to argue that it is possible for multiple incarnations to exist. And he goes through several lines of argument. This is sort of the gist of it. He talks about the power of a divine person being infinite, and the fact that a divine person had assumed one human nature doesn't prevent that infinite power from assuming a second or ad infinitum nature. So from that point of view, Aquinas argues that multiple incarnations of the second person of the Trinity, the Son, the Christ, or even that the other persons of the Trinity could incarnate themselves. Now, this leads to a lot of interesting argument and discussion in the literature. Here are two aspects of this, and then I'll close so we have time for a little bit of discussion. Hellwaite, in the Theology in 2001, argues that Aquinas was mistaken in allowing multiple incarnations for two reasons. One is to allow incarnations of the Father or the Holy Spirit, and now I'm talking to my Catholic colleagues here, so if you're not, forgive me for getting really narrow in this, but I think it's important to sort of dig deep into this. So because the Father and the Holy Spirit are not the creators, then it's not as fitting, he argues, for them to be incarnated as it is for the Son to be incarnated. That's kind of a value judgment. I think it's a weak argument, but we can discuss it. And then he goes on to multiple incarnations of the Son, and here he makes a very interesting point, that if you argue that the second person of the Trinity can be incarnated in multiple individuals, then you lose the essential and key central aspect of the incarnation of Jesus Christ as being both God and man in the same individual. You end up with a situation where you have kind of an Arianism or some other sort of heresy where the individual has God in him or her in some way, but not fully integrated in the way that we think of Jesus Christ. So I think his argument, which is really only summed up here in a very compact way, is actually a good one. It's hard to imagine, if we think of the Trinity, if we think of the incarnation in the way that we should, as Jesus Christ is true God and true man at the same time, to have that happen multiple times. Now, Paul then comes to the rescue of Aquinas by pointing out that Aquinas is not considering divine motivation or the implications of such an incarnation, but simply was trying to argue whether there are limits to divine power to do so, and not whether it actually happened. So, it would be an interesting question then to ask, if there are other intelligent, self-aware life forms in the cosmos, then what happens to them in terms of salvation history? That, I think, is the central question, for which, in the end, Marie George, in this whole book, doesn't really have an answer, and is something that we can certainly ponder. But the other aspects of encountering aliens, encountering extraterrestrials, I would argue, Christians are well equipped for. In particular, how would Christians react to contact? You read in some of the secular literature that Christians will flee in panic, or you know, they will kill themselves or whatever. I mean, they'll be totally disarmed by this. Actually, Christians and Jews and Muslims all have experience with angels, which I'm not arguing are extraterrestrials, but the kind of contact you might imagine that humans would have with a very advanced or even incorporeal, possibly, extraterrestrial species would be very much like encounters with angels, even with corporeal aliens, because it will happen on their terms. It will be done in such a way that it will be difficult for, I think, humans to comprehend and understand. Remember, the likelihood that we would meet an extraterrestrial civilization that is exactly on our level in terms of advancement, either culturally or scientifically or theologically or whatever, is very, very small. And if they are, you know, behind us, they're not going to come to us, all right? And we're not at the point where we're going to come to them. So whatever we're likely to find is going to be far more advanced. And so I think our experience in encounters of humans with angels might actually provide something of a lesson in that regard. And then finally, how would Christians react to evidence that we're alone in the cosmos? There's a lot of talk in books about finding extraterrestrials about deep cosmic loneliness, about a feeling that, you know, how would humans handle being the only ones in the cosmos? And I think from the Christian point of view, that's not a problem, because we're not, in fact, alone in the universe. In the Revelation of John, Revelation chapter 21, verses 1 to 4, when John sees in his vision a new heaven and a new earth, and he sees the holy city, the new Jerusalem, coming down out of heaven from God, he hears a loud voice from the throne of heaven saying, "Behold, God's dwelling is with the human race. He will dwell with them, and they will be his people, and God himself will always be with them." And Jesus himself, at the end of the Gospel of Matthew, assures his disciples, "I am with you always, even to the end of the age." So in fact, we know already that we're not alone in the cosmos. Thank you. Okay, so as a colleague of mine at JPL does when he wants discussion, he stands up here and he just says, discuss.
Could you go back to that quote that was 3 pages back? Was it Aquinas about multiple incarnations? Was that a direct quote? Or
that one, yeah, it's from the Summa, quote 3, question 3, article 7.
So what was the substance of, what was like the principle should be possible for God incarnate multiple times? And
yeah.
The idea would be that the resurrected body would just merge
into
one.
No, he doesn't go into the how. He asks, is it possible? He asks several questions. The two that are pertinent are, number one, is it possible for the Father or the Holy Spirit to incarnate as well as the Son? And comes up with the answer, yes. And the other is it possible for the Son to be incarnated in more than one individual, and comes up with a yes on that too.
In the Summa.
In the Summa, yeah, that's right. Which, again, you know, others have argued he's mistaken on. But when you actually read his arguments, I agree with Paul that he's not trying to argue that this has happened, but he's simply restricting himself to the question of whether there are intrinsic limits to the power to do that. So, for example, there are intrinsic limits to what God can do. 1 + 1 can't be 3, for example. It's just incoherent. If we deny Jesus Christ as Son of God, Jesus Christ can't deny himself. So that has consequences for us. So, you know, doesn't everything can't happen even if it's intrinsically illogical. And what Aquinas is trying to do is to show that there's no intrinsic logical contradiction to those things happening. He's not saying that it happened.
And is the discussion of like the objections and the response to the objection, does it deal sort of sufficiently with?
It does. And in fact, yeah, so I didn't bring the Summa with me, but I mean, Heddleweight actually says at the beginning of his article, I agree with all the objections in Aquinas' article on that particular one. He said, I think they're right. Yeah. Yes?
On the next slide, when you say that we are not alone here, isn't the Bible talking about spirits like angels and stuff? Spiritual entities, not physical ones. So isn't it the case?
Well, in this case, no, because Jesus Christ is not spirit. It's flesh and spirit.
Yes, but only him.
Well, and he's God. So,
yes, but
right.
We don't have, besides Jesus Christ and us, any evidence in the Bible that we are not alone.
Right. No, that's absolutely true. And in fact, so that goes back to this question that Marie George poses, which she uses Aquinas for, and that is the fact that there is an absence of explicit discussion of extraterrestrials in the Bible, is that a problem if it turns out there are extraterrestrials? And Aquinas, although he's not answering the question in exactly that way, says no, it's not a problem, because the Bible doesn't contain everything that exists in the way that you would actually describe it if you were fully knowledgeable about it. If we go back to that quote of his. So he says, faith in sacred scripture intended for our salvation and not, he doesn't say instruction in science, that's a modern rewording of it. But he then says that there are things that might exist that have been signified and not explicitly called out. And of course, he assumed that Moses wrote the five books of Moses, which he probably didn't do. But anyway, that whoever wrote this, the time signified that by the names of corporeal things, because Moses spoke to uneducated people who weren't able to grasp things of an incorporeal nature. So the Bible doesn't contain everything that we know exists today because that was not essential for the purpose of the illumination of humans in terms of their salvation history. Actually, Lemaître, Georges Lemaître, the Belgian priest and cosmologist, says this explicitly as well, and I forget what talk he gave, but he says, straight out, he says that St. Paul didn't need to understand general relativity. There's no general relativity in the New Testament because it's not essential for the salvation of man, and it would be incoherent with what people understood at the time. So he's trying to make the point that you don't, it's not an encyclopedia. It has a specific purpose. Let's see. Yes, down in front first. Go ahead.
Professor, as a scientist, do you have an explanation for UFOs?
I do. I think that they are a combination of misperceived natural phenomena, psychological phenomena that people have, or straight-out frauds. I think that, you know, almost every case, when it's examined really closely, including this abduction of this married couple in the 1960s, I think, Betty and, I can't remember the last names, you find enough inconsistencies, as convincing as the story seemed, that it just doesn't hold up. That's my view on UFOs. I don't think we're being visited by spaceships. You know, as a kid, I wished we were. I mean, I read Eric von Daniken and all that, but it just doesn't hold up. So, yes.
So I kind of have like two questions.
Yeah.
The first one is, even if we do discover extraterrestrial life, it seems like they would be so far away. Like life would be traveled so fast, so there would be a communication barrier to even discuss faith in the first place.
Yeah, so that's a terrific point, which I was hoping someone would ask about. So imagine that you get a signal, and it's coming from something that is really close, okay, which means maybe 30 light years away. And so the first message you get is there is no God. Okay, and then you send a signal back saying, well, you know, what do you actually mean? What are you trying to say when you say there is no God? Do you have proof of that? And then you get an answer back. Well, that whole exchange took you 90 years. Okay, and maybe these aliens are inveterate liars. Maybe they're totally ignorant of divinity. You don't, yes, you don't really know. That's much, as you say, that is almost certainly the kind of interaction we're going to have with extraterrestrials if extraterrestrials exist. And it's going to be very frustrating. The other kind, where they actually come to Earth and they say, here is all of knowledge, I think poses a deeper threat to science than it does to faith, because we spend $100 billion a year in this country on research, and if someone's going to come and tell us all the answers, we're not going to be spending that amount of money, and all of us are out of a job. So that could be even more traumatic than, you know, finding out that there might perhaps have to be some modifications around the periphery of certain religions. And if you want to know my view is that I don't know if there are extraterrestrials out there, but I know that the central tenets of my faith are right, and I think, as Pope John Paul II said, and others before him, that, you know, once we fully understand what we're encountering, there won't be an incompatibility between the two. Any incompatibility will be due to an incomplete understanding of one or the other.
Yeah, that was kind of related to my second question, was do you think, like, the Christian faith would be affected differently if we find, like, ET or whatever to be a hostile or, like, non-agreeing, or versus if they're, like, super accepting or friendly and stuff like that?
You mean if they come out of their spaceship and they're completely polemical and you can't get a word in edgewise? I don't know.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, part of the problem is that almost all of these scenarios are really based on human cultural experiences throughout our own history, where different peoples have had their land invaded by a group that, you know, has either utterly obliterated them or completely destroyed their culture or dominated them, for example. I mean, these are all just replays of things in history where you take out the name of the people that came and you put in ET instead. And I have to say that the way that evolution, Darwinian evolution works, if there are other intelligent software beings, I think they're going to be so different that just trying to establish a common basis of communication is going to be really tough. Which, I mean, people were very optimistic about dolphins in the 1960s. Carl Sagan, for example. You know, everyone thought they were intelligent, we're going to crack their code, and nothing came of it. Yes?
With that being said, has there been any research looking into, or maybe like theological discussion, looking into like if ET is so intrinsically different than humanity, and because like the Bible is formed like to a human experience, mm-hmm. like wouldn't that mean that maybe their relationship with God is so entirely different that it's not perceivable for us, like because our experience is tailored around the human experience?
Yep.
So wouldn't that be something else to argue is like maybe we don't even know what that experience would look like with an ET relationship with
yep.
God? So like has there been any like investigation into that or like thought?
So Aquinas covers that a little bit in his discussions of what actually is a human being. You know, what do you have to take away from a human being for them not to be a human being? Somewhat limited discussion, but it's interesting nonetheless. And then the most recent modern example of that is that in Marie George's book, she talks a lot about the way that humans interact with angels as a model for, she's not saying that angels are ETs, but as a model for the difficulties with which humans would interact with something that is so different in the way that you describe, that might in some way have a relationship to God that maybe is closer in some sense or is just so different. And she, there's some, you know, many interesting points she makes about those kinds of interactions. Of course, it's all not definitive because there's nothing you can test it with, right? But it is thought-provoking. Yeah. Yes?
With both the F sub L and F sub I, as you indicated, I mean, there are philosophical questions about that.
Yes, there are.
What does it take for life to exist? Is it just the chemistry that's there?
Yeah.
What's the origin here? And I mean, I think one could make the philosophical case that life requires a divine initiative.
Yes.
So we don't know even for ourselves. I mean, you said that, you know, how it originated.
Right.
If you add to that F sub I, that clearly requires a divine initiative, at least when
right.
we would argue that philosophically and Aquinas would do so. Even in our own case, in the case of procreation, it doesn't simply come from the parents. God must create the rational soul.
Right.
In the special divine action. So if you take that, the likelihood for that to occur elsewhere is, of course, even more speculative. That's
right.
not a matter of science anymore.
Right.
That's really a theological question at that point. I mean, would God do that? Would we expect the Bible to talk about it? If not, I mean, you had the Aquinas quote on that.
Yeah.
That really takes it out of the field of science altogether.
Oh, it does, yeah. So, you know, the part that is science would be to replace I for intelligent with, and unfortunately this C it stands for communication, but replace I with complex, okay?
Mm-hmm.
So let's make it F sub M, the fraction of those planets where life actually does form that go on to develop multicellular complex life into which God can imbue a soul. And that can be approached scientifically because we have it in the fossil record. And that's the part that takes so long. And that's what's sobering about that. So, but the intelligence part, I agree, has that extra step that is not scientifically accessible. As far as your first question goes, Paul Davies, who's a physicist at ASU, has argued in a couple of books that there has to be a kind of a principle, a life principle, that would drive the system toward actually forming life. And he it's like you have to go through the whole book to get the gist of it. It's thought-provoking, but it has to do with this question of, you know, the anthropocentric universe and the fine-tuning of different constants and so on. But in the end, you know, you could ask, if he's right, what does that mean? Is that principle the divine principle in some way? And he himself is not a traditional Christian, as far as I know. But he's a good physicist, and they're both good books. Yes?
Kind of like going off of that, just a thought, and what is what you thought. If we're saying God can, I guess, create life on other planets, what's stopping him from creating it again here on Earth? We're saying that there's like intelligent life elsewhere. Mm-hmm. Why does it have to be limited to just humans here on Earth? Does that like point to anything? That maybe there is a lack of intelligent life out there?
So I didn't quite understand the premise of your argument. Can you say it again?
Right. So I'm just wondering if God can create intelligent life elsewhere in the universe, mm-hmm. what's stopping him from doing it again on Earth to save dolphins?
Oh, right. Okay. Yeah. So why don't we have more than one?
Sure.
There is a scientific and there's a philosophical explanation. The evolutionary biologists would say that true intelligence and self-awareness is so specialized that the likelihood of it happening is small, which would actually argue that we're alone in the universe. I mean, that would be an evolutionary biological argument for it. The other would be, from the theological point of view, I don't think Aquinas actually addresses the question in that way, but humans were God's special creation, so that he could love us, and there would be a reflection of the image of God in the cosmos. And so, why would he then create that twice? Actually, there is an argument with Aquinas about that. So, in fact, Aquinas addresses the question of the specialness of humans. On the one hand, to create something that is so perfect in a certain sense as the image of God, to do that twice would be redundant and would make no sense to duplicate perfection. But on the other hand, something that's really that special, why not create many things that are so special? That would be great. And I can't remember which side Aquinas comes down on, but he articulates that argument. I believe it's in the Summa as well. So, yes, very good point.
Are these passages in Mary George's article?
Mary George's article has all the passages that I included. And in fact, I have a PDF of it, so you can just have this.
Great.
Lighten my load on the way back. All right. Okay.
Just a comment. With my limited knowledge of Aquinas, and I think I heard a comment, and I think you're implying it as well when you talk about Moses.
Mm-hmm.
Because, philosophically, I think it's around, question 61 of the Prima Pars,
mm-hmm.
where he's talking about creation, right, and the different levels of creation. And you're talking about incorporeal beings as well. Right?
Yeah.
And that's what I think that's the key term that Aquinas is referring to, different intellectual substances, right?
Yes.
Always
through right.
creation.
Yes.
Which again being the first cause.
Yes.
God being the first cause. So he goes about unpacking that throughout the.
Right. He does. But then this. Business about imbuing celestial objects with intelligence comes from other writing that I think is outside of the Summa, but it's still Aquinas.
Yeah.
I have to say, although you can't rewrite history, it's just it would be great to imagine that if Aquinas were to come back and have be steeped in sort of modern astronomy, what he might write about, the question of ET from the context of everything else he's thought about. Because his writings really were hampered by the lack of understanding that the Earth was one of many potentially habitable planets, the cosmos, something we know now that really was not understood at the time that he wrote. Yes. Yeah, go ahead.
So you're saying that aliens aren't really in Area 51, or...
I'm afraid, yes, that's right. One of the funniest movies I ever watched, I was on the floor for the whole thing, was something called Alien Autopsy. And it was a send-up of these grainy 8mm films that supposedly purported to show an alien autopsy. And the plot of the movie is that these people get a hold of this film and... they lose it or something like that, and so they have to recreate it. And so the whole film is about the recreation of the alien autopsy film. I recommend it highly. It will disabuse you of any sense of mystery about Area 51. It worked for me, yes.
So what's going to be Juno's objective? Will it explore Europa?
Great question. So Juno... which is in orbit around Jupiter now and is about halfway through its mission, is primarily to look at Jupiter as a planet, to measure the interior structure by measuring the gravity field, which changes the path of the spacecraft, magnetic fields, understanding the atmosphere. We're trying to measure the deep water abundance in Jupiter, which tells us how much elemental oxygen is there. But it turns out that even though this orbit that it's on is not optimized for studying the satellites, there have been some good observations of Io and Europa. And so one of the instruments is called JIRAM, J-I-R-A-M. It's a spectrometer. It was built by the Italian Space Agency. And there was just a paper published on spectra of Europa from JIRAM by Juno. So now it's not going to crack open the question of whether there's life in Europa, but it'll be sort of a useful benchmark for when we actually go there with Europa Clipper. So Europa Clipper is the mission that's under development that will go and make very close flybys of Europa multiple times, and that hopefully will tell us about the nature of the ocean. Juno's just not in the right orbit. Juno's in a really stretched out orbit, very elongated, so that it can get in close to Jupiter without spending a lot of time in the main part of the radiation belts, which would kill the electronics. And so it literally comes screaming in, makes this very close flyby of Jupiter in every orbit, and goes screaming out again, and so it goes past the orbits of the Gallian moons too quickly for good observations. Okay. Well, thank you for... bearing with me for a long time.